This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. And before we get started with our array of guests today, I do want to note that in the last few hours, it has been reported that Charles Elson Buddy Romer III, former governor of Louisiana, number 52 on the honor roll, died this morning at the age of 77, October 4th, 1943 to May 17th, 2021, for Buddy Romer, four-term congressman, one-term governor, one of the most interesting people in Louisiana political lore, and we will be talking about his life and legacy in the days to come. But he was a person who was well-known here in Baton Rouge, even though he was from the Bossier Parish area. He was a frequent visitor, as we know, back in the day at the old Books a Million on Perkins. He was one of our first members of our Saturday Coffee Group, and the founder of that group, Jim Featherston, the late great journalist, died in 2000 at the age of 77. And today we lose former Governor Buddy Romer at 77. He fought diabetes for almost 50 years gallantly, and we wish the best to his wife, Scarlett, and his children, Chaz, Dakota, and Caroline. We're joined now by David Lewis, father of Jade Lewis. He has been in the news, and he joins us from Auckland, New Zealand. And we do want to set him up as far as people who are unfamiliar with David. He was a star tennis player in his own right, ranked in the top 100 in the world at one point. His brother Chris made it to the Wimbledon Finals in 1983, losing to John McEnroe. And his daughter Jade was a prize recruit for LSU, and in the year of 2017, she agreed to come to Tigertown, and as we know now, her friend, Drake Davis, became violent in their relationship and actually was in jail as a result of some of his actions, and now he is accused of abusing other women. And at LSU, as we know, there have been other athletes, most prominently Darius Geis, who is accused of rape in addition to other misdeeds, including sexually harassing a 70-year-old security guard at the Superdome. The Hush Blackwell report gave evidence of this, and Jade Lewis was in that report many times, as you can suspect, and David Lewis trusted LSU from thousands of miles away to protect his daughter. And let's begin there. Why did she choose LSU, David? And thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, good morning, Jim. Why did she join LSU? Well, I think you sort of said it a little bit there already. We trusted the coaches. I knew one of the co-head coaches a little bit because he was a former player, and we believed that Jade could learn something from the coaches, obviously, while she was at LSU, and the facilities were great, and it was just a good opportunity for her to work with them.
She was barely 18 years old when she arrived. Is that correct?
She had just turned 18. She started in January 2017, and she had turned 18 in December 2016. So literally two or three weeks before putting her foot on LSU, she had turned 18.
And to put it in context, at the time, and she meets Drake Davis shortly after her arrival here, he's a bit older than she, and he is from this area, and of course, Jade is from a country many thousands of miles away, has no family, is probably searching for friends and associates, and she meets him. And her coaches at that time were the same people who are head coaches now at LSU, the tennis coaches who were husband and wife. Tell us about them and how they were involved in her recruiting.
Well, at the end of 2015, so when Jade was, she still had another year or a year and a half to finish school, so she was obviously sought after with her recruiting, and then Mike Sell, one of the coaches, was in touch with me, and obviously a lot of other universities were trying to recruit Jade, but a big reason also for Jade to go to LSU was because they offered her, being the coaches, offered her a lifetime scholarship. If she went even for one semester and turned pro, she could return back to LSU at any stage if after her pro career or she got an injury, for example, that she'd go back and finish her studies and her academics to get a degree. So that was also another reason why she went there.
She was very young, 18 years old, on a campus in a foreign land, and she meets Drake Davis fairly soon after coming here. Is that right?
She met her, I think, pretty early in the piece, because she had told us she'd met a football player, actually. And she was on campus. She was in the dorms. Obviously, we trusted our daughter that she was in good hands, not only with the coaches, but the administration, the trainers for the team. We were aware that she had met the football player, and you know, we sort of had an eye on things, obviously, as parents do, but... it's a long story. There are a lot of details over, you know, from that point through to now. And obviously, as time went by, we became more and more suspicious of certain things up until the point that we learned there was actually violence involved during that semester, the 2017 spring semester.
The very first semester. And
yes.
And violence of any kind is inappropriate in... slapping somebody, a man against a woman, with a size variance. And by the way, Drake Davis is a big man. He's 6'4", 220 pounds. Your daughter's an athlete, but she's nowhere near his size.
No, she's 5'7", and maybe 125 pounds or something. But, yeah, as I mentioned, that we didn't know she had been assaulted until later in the summer of 2017, but now we know a lot more, obviously, as time has passed by and a lot of facts have come out. But we do know that our daughter was punched in the stomach, actually on May the 19th, 2017, several days before she went to go to the NCAA individuals, which she was competing a few days later. So we know now she was punched. Jade reported it to the tennis trainer. She reported that assault to the tennis trainer. And she also told other football players about it, because they had to get her belongings out of the apartment, and also tennis girls on the team knew about it. They were receiving text messages saying that this guy had punched our daughter, because that's in the police report. One of the tennis players received a text message, who was actually in the Hush Blackwell report as well, kind of. So there's a lot of details. I can't go into more now,
right.
But she was assaulted. It wasn't reported. She reported it to that trainer, who didn't report it to Title IX. I would imagine he told the tennis coaches and also his superiors. I would imagine that's what happened. But he didn't report it to Title IX. I actually tried to call that person a little bit later in 2019, but he hung the phone up on me. So I didn't find out until 2 months later. I knew something, it was toxic. I knew things weren't great earlier on in that summer, but I didn't find out until later in July for a fact that our daughter had been assaulted. So when I found that out, I told the coach that, you know, now I know that she's been assaulted and we expect something to happen. At the same time, we know the coaches, because Jade had left after that semester to turn pro. And so, and she was quite confused, because obviously she was in this abusive relationship had begun. So during that summer, she had turned pro, and at the same time, though, the coaches were still trying to encourage her to return back to LSU.
877-217-5757, if you'd like to join our conversation. This is a sensitive topic, a father talking about the abuse of his daughter, and a harrowing acknowledgement for any parent to know that this is happening to their child, but you were several thousand miles away, and
Jim, if I can correct you there, we were actually in Baton Rouge at the time.
Okay,
we were in Baton Rouge at the time. She was on campus, but basically under our noses. This was the beginning. Put it that way.
At one point,
first semester we were there.
I got you. At one point, her ribs were broken, right?
That was when she returned. So just to fast forward, she turned pro in the summer of 2017. She ended up returning or re-enrolling back, and she was physically back at LSU nearly a year later in March 2018. And when she returned, now remember at this stage, the trainer knew from the May 2017 assault, and I told Michael Sell, and we can only assume that the trainer also told the coaches and the superiors. The football players knew because they had to get the belongings out of her apartment, so we would think they would have told the coaches. And also another girl, at least one or two girls, knew on the tennis team, so I'd imagine they would have told the coaches as well. So now she goes back in March of 2018, nearly a year later, and within days, I think she waved to a friend and he broke her ribs for that reason, punched her and broke her ribs.
And we're about to go to a break, but it appears that Davis had some kind of a hold that went beyond a physical domination of your daughter. He was involved in her life to the point where she was unable to break free from him emotionally, it appears. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, when abuse is continuous and trauma, there, you know, a lot of things happen. So, I mean, you know, that takes quite a while to explain how. I mean, most people know that victims of abuse go through.
Okay, we do have to take a break. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing. We're visiting with David Lewis, father of Jade Lewis, LSU tennis star of a few years ago. She's only 22 today, but she, in her time here, was abused by Drake Davis, a friend who they were in a relationship, and it was an abusive relationship. At one point, Jade had her ribs broken, and she was a star athlete, and LSU knew about this, did not report it. But before we get there, David Lewis, you were talking about the hold emotionally that Drake Davis had over your daughter. It appears she was a young person and had fallen head over heels for this man, and he turned out to be a pretty bad guy.
Well, head over heels, perhaps groomed, but when we go, just to touch on the abuse victims, obviously the victims of abuse are ashamed and they're embarrassed to tell. You know, the parents are often the last ones to know. And also, Jade was on the receiving ends of death threats and blackmail.
Really? From whom?
From him, from the person we're talking about. He was in the police report. It says in there she was blackmailed and she was getting, she was being threatened to kill, and she was being threatened, she was being told to kill herself.
Hmm. LSU had a report that from Davis himself saying that he had punched her in the stomach, and then he reportedly recanted that confession, and it was never sent to the Title IX office after the disavowing of doing this. But does that pass the smell test with you?
Well, I actually read that in the police report when it came out, that one of the administrators high up received a text message from the perpetrator on April the 14th that he had assaulted our daughter. And he didn't report that to the authorities. He reported it to nobody, which I believe is a breaking federal law. And the only reason that text message surfaced was because the Attorney General's office ran a forensic data analysis on Davis's phones once he was arrested and they were looking for further evidence. Otherwise, that text message would have never have surfaced. And I'm sure that person, he even when others came forward and everyone knew about it, it only surfaced for that reason. And don't forget, Jim, there was also another victim of this perpetrator who was abused at the end of 2016. So already before Jade stepped foot on campus, another one in October had been abused or reported to the football staff. So they already knew he was an abuser before he had abused Jade.
He went to jail, has, as you state, other allegations that are serious against him. Then there's Darius Geis, who brings it to an even darker level with allegations of rape. And LSU has all but acknowledged that it didn't do what it should have done. In retrospect, are you amazed at the scope of this, and do you think that LSU has taken the right steps to address any further problems that might occur?
The way they handle it, Jim, I mean, it went from the trainer, and eventually, based on their timeline, later, months later, weeks later, they all have different timelines. It ended up at the general counsel's office, legal department, after she was strangled one night, nearly killed. She was close to being killed. they still, after all this, they still, this is before he was arrested, they still didn't take any steps to protect my daughter. The only punishment, the football player remained on the team. He wasn't punished. I wonder why the head coach allowed him to stay on the team. I would like to know. The only punishment that someone received was my daughter by reporting it. They punished her for having a candle in her room.
My goodness, what did they do to her?
They found a candle in her room. That's what they did. After she had been assaulted, strangled, nothing happened to the perpetrator, but they found a candle in Jade's room, so they punished her. That's what's happened.
All right.
And then months later, they finally got, he was arrested because I believe they couldn't keep the lid on things anymore, so they had to. That was it. This was the biggest cover-up that one could imagine. And they nearly risked our daughter being killed in the process.
All right, well, and for those unfamiliar, the coach at that time was not Les Miles. He was gone. The coach was Ed Orgeron. He was coach from the day that Jade Lewis stepped foot on the campus until the day she left. So it is
correct.
It is curious that Miles, who did some things wrong, as we know, and a lot of people who have left LSU are taking the heat in most cases, and yet there are people who are there, including the current coach, who have not been held accountable. What do you think?
Well, Jim, the first victim, or the victim for Jay, that was in October, and I believe Les Miles was fired on September the 25th. So the other victim reported to the wide receiver coach back then. So that's also after Miles was coach. So that's the second one. So that's also under his head coach. Okay, so you've got the tennis coaches, you've got football players raping and assaulting tennis players. Two girls on the tennis team, one was apparently or allegedly raped by Geis, and the tennis coach, when she reported, and the father reported to the tennis coach, said your daughter's a liar. The other one in the Hush Blackwell report, there was another girl raped on the tennis team by a football player. Our one was nearly strangled to death by a football player. And there's also another girl who's part of the lawsuit, I believe, who was emotionally and mentally abused by the tennis coach. I mean, I cannot believe these people still have jobs. It's unfathomable. It's unbelievable.
Do you think this is a house of cards?
This is definitely a house of cards. And my question is, who is protecting them?
I mentioned that right now LSU is saying that it's doing things to change the pattern of misconduct that occurred, and it was a serious pattern. Are you confident that the right steps have been taken?
By banning somebody for attending football games? Are you kidding me? By suspending them for 30 days and 21 days when they're covering up nearly attempted murder and rape?
Mm-hmm.
Are you kidding me?
Now, the person you're speaking of, the person you're speaking of has been punished, although many say not sufficiently. But what about the coaches? The coaches seem to be the ones who were the closest to the action here. I haven't heard any effort to suspend Mike Sell, for example.
Well, none of them allowed to talk. They've all been muzzled up since the first USA Today report came out. No one's talking, right? They need to talk. We need answers. I hope the senators or the Senate committee, they said they have the possibility to subpoena them. Let's hope that happens. The governor's been very quiet. I'm just wondering, is the governor the one who is ultimately in charge? Who's in charge? Is it the Board of Supervisors? Who makes these decisions to get to the truth?
Well, all of those people have authority, but many of them, I'm sure, know less about it than I do, and I'm learning things as you speak. But your daughter is part of a lawsuit involving, I think, six other women. What is she seeking other than justice? Do you think this is something that warrants some kind of substantial response from LSU?
Well, firstly, I believe all those who are complicit in enabling and cover all these crimes up need to be held fully accountable, civilly and criminally by law. So I guess that's what the lawsuit's about. and that needs to happen to get to the bottom of things.
Are you confident that will happen?
I think the U.S. Department of Education also investigating both the Clery Act and Title IX, so that's another investigation going on. I do hope that the Senate committee continue pursuing to get justice and to get to the bottom of this and get questions answered by everyone that's been muzzled up. That needs to happen because you mentioned the Hush-Blackwell report and their 18 recommendations. You can throw those recommendations out the window because everyone who's there, who's been complicit, and there are many, they cannot be trusted. They need to be fired immediately because so long as those people are there, that campus is not safe.
We're going to take a short break and spend a few more minutes with David Lewis, who is a brave man to talk about his daughter in the most personal of matters, but he feels it is a necessity, and we're pleased that he is telling the story that needs to be told. We'll be back with him and also hear from Senator Jay Luno. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. David Lewis, father of Jade Lewis, former LSU tennis star, who was 18 years old when she arrived on the campus here in Baton Rouge in 2017 and started a relationship with Drake Davis, who, as we know, and this has been fleshed out in court proceedings, he beat the hell out of her, and LSU knew about this and failed to report it, and the beatings continued, and now there is litigation, as you would expect. And David Lewis has bravely joined us from Auckland, New Zealand, which is his home. What time is it there, by the way, David, as we speak to you?
We are 2:30 a.m. in the morning Tuesday, so we're some time ahead of you.
Okay, yes, but it is good to have you join us at any time, and I commend you for being a stalwart for your daughter. How is she doing?
She is rebuilding. She's gone through a lot, obviously, a lot of things. There's many things that have happened in our lives over the last few years. But not only is this for Jade, this is for all the other victims, and it's also for all the other girls or victims or guys, if that's the case, that are going to step on that campus in the future. Drastic changes need to be made. Drastic changes. People need to get fired and be held accountable.
The LSU has hired a new president, and Bill Huey writes, my question is, why would William Tate IV or anybody want to step into this mess? This is a story that is not going away. There is litigation, and there is concern. And LSU's brand is as majestic as any in the state, but that brand has been tarnished by this. And Sharon Lewis, no relation to David or Jade, she said it's all about the brand. Do you think that maybe that's why some of this stuff was not revealed when it should have been to the proper authorities?
This is a lot of it to do with protecting the football program and making sure to win at all costs. And victims on campus are nothing more than a piece of meat for a lot of people. They couldn't care less about them, as we saw with our daughter and all the other girls, the victims who have come forward and been raped and mistreated, stonewalled to try and get police records, like just like what we've gone through to try and get more information. We've been lied to, we've been stonewalled, we've been jerked around. This is an organization that is fighting so hard, to, or an institution now that's fighting so hard to cover up their cover-ups. It's criminal behavior, I think. It's just... I think also the lawsuit is a RICO. Is that RICO? Is it Racketeering Influence Criminal
RICO,
Act or,
yes.
or whatever it's called? Yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't disagree with that.
David, thank you for joining us today, and best of luck to you and your wife and to Jade. I'm reluctant to bring this up, but I will, and I think it'll put into context the kind of trauma that your family has faced. To Jade's sister, your other daughter, was killed, so you have been through the ringer, my friend, and we wish you the best. Are you okay?
We take a day at a time, and we seek justice, and I hope that everyone out there, if there's other victims who have been, you know, mistreated at LSU, I hope they have the strength and the courage to step forward, because there's a lot of support out there. And without the support and without everyone like that, we're not going to hold these people accountable and make changes. That needs to happen.
Thank you, and best of luck to you, sir. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you.
We're joined now by Senator Jay Luno, Democrat from Alexandria. And Went to Pineville High School, by the way. But Jay Luno is one of only, let's see, there are 12 Democrats in the Senate, and there are 35 in the House, so that's only 47 of the 144-member body. And then when we get down to white Democrats, it's a dwindling number. He represents seven parishes, not only his home parish of Rapides, but Bienville, Grant, Jackson, Lincoln, Natchitoches, and Wynn. And he's an attorney, member of the state Senate since 2016, and he has been there through the Edwards years, two terms now. Senator Luno, before we get to the topic at hand, how is the overall environment right now? We're getting into some really crazy legislation, but are the lawmakers holding up okay?
You know, so far so good. But we are getting some really difficult legislation these days, and some kind of unnecessary, and some things that are very divisive. But we're going to make it through. We've got 3.5 weeks about left, and so we're going to make it.
Well, one of the measures that you are involved in is one that involves the tax code. Senate Bill 240 is the bill we're speaking of. It would reform the tax code in our state by not allowing tax credits to a business once a tax liability has been zeroed out, so that businesses would not, quote, make money from taxes, from the taxes to their businesses. Seems like a common sense thing, but as we know, sometimes these things meet with great resistance. How is the measure looking?
It's being met with great resistance. That's exactly how it's looking. You know, the thing about it is a common sense measure. In Louisiana, we have more tax credits, rebates, exemptions than any other state in the United States. And in fact, the price tag is somewhere around $9 billion annually. So it is something that we need to look at very carefully. Now, these are not all unnecessary. Some of them are very good incentive programs to get business to locate in Louisiana. But some of them have just been on the books perpetually for decades. And it makes it where it's very difficult to manage the system. And as you said, my bill is a simple bill to me. It says that you can reduce your tax liability down to zero, but you can't go below zero. We have lots of companies that get rebates and they don't pay any taxes. And that's unfortunate because primarily what happens, we have small businesses that pay corporate income tax, and they're subsidizing bigger businesses that have more deductions and rebates and credits. And so this first came on my radar several years ago when, I don't know the numbers exactly, but if memory serves me, we paid back in credits, rebates, and exemptions about $25 million more in corporate taxation than we took in. So we would have been better off to not have corporate tax for that year, to say we're going to exempt all corporate taxes this year, but nobody gets any rebates. So that was when we first started looking at it, and it is very complex, frankly. In fact, we've done multiple amendments on this bill already to get it in a fashion where it was reasonable and fair to all the businesses involved.
The bill actually made it out of Senate, voted 20-16. It's headed to the House. Tracy at the Capitol says LABI is using all of its might, and it is considerable, to fight it. Why is the business lobby against it?
Because it's a money-making tool for them. The businesses make lots of money off of this, off the state of Louisiana. And like I said, being subsidized by other entities. And that's the unfortunate thing, is that small business has very little voice at the Capitol. And it's in fact, sometimes their own organizations lobby against their positions for the bigger businesses. And that's very unfortunate. And the difficulty is when lobby comes to them and says this is going to be a bill that's going to be scored. In other words, your lobby score could be affected by it. And there are a lot of legislators that won't vote for a bill, that's going to be scored by lobby. And that's unfortunate because this is a bill that we all should get behind. It's corporate welfare at its worst. You know, we're subsidizing these companies.
It will be fascinating to see how it plays out, but how much, it's a good question from a listener, this is from Hal in Monroe, how much does the state lose by having this ability for business to basically not only zero out their taxes, but make money from taxes?
So when the first fiscal note came out on this bill, it was $265 million a year. Since then, we've, like I said, we exempted out some entities because it was the right thing to do. For example, licensed vehicle dealers, mobile homes, RVs, automobiles, things like that, they get an exemption or credit back for their inventory tax they pay. And that is a tax that is relied on heavily by local municipalities. And so it was a situation where they were not getting back more than they were paying in. So we exempted those out. There are some other industries that I understand are going to be coming to us for the House side that they want to be exempted out too. And quite frankly, if they're the same situation, I'm going to seriously consider exempting them out too. So now the price tag is down to around $230 million a year that we will get in additional revenue. So that's, you know, even exempting those out, we're still at $230 million that's being credited back to these people below zero.
That's significant, a quarter of $1 billion. How does the governor stand?
You know, the governor's office has been pretty neutral on this bill. It's not one that they're backing or against one way or the other. I'm planning to meet with the governor at some point this week and talk to him about this bill and ask for his support.
Well, amid the legislature getting into a lot of social issues, and quite often that happens when the state has money, and for this year the state has money, there are other matters that are capturing the fancy not only of the people in the state but elsewhere. And a listener asks about marijuana legislation. That surprisingly has gained some momentum. I don't know if it's going to make the finish line, but are you surprised about where we are right now?
I'm not really, because the testimony that we've had over the years dealing with medical marijuana has just been so convincing. You know, to me, I was not a person that was inclined to vote to legalize marijuana, but I've changed my position because I believe, first of all, I believe in the science that we've been told. I see how it's affected people's lives and how it's helped them through medicinal marijuana and the forms that we have legalized now. And I think that the populace in the state of Louisiana, we've seen statewide polls that in the 70s and 80s for medicinal marijuana and even for legalizing. I think that it was the right step to decriminalize it. We just can't continue to afford to have people clogging up our jail systems for possession of marijuana charges, and that's happening in a lot of places in Louisiana.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Senator Jay Luno, Democrat from the great city of Alexandria. And we're back, also slated to hear from Colonel Janet Humphreys about some major happenings across the river from us. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. On deck is Colonel Janet Humphreys, but we're spending a few more minutes with Senator Wendell J. Luno, Democrat from Alexandria, represents District 29. 877-217-5757. Please be brief. Jim and Walker, you're on the air. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, gentlemen. I think it's pretty clear that if there is a politician in Louisiana who is against this bill, they're on the take from big business, whether that take is in campaign contributions or whatever. They're getting paid to put somebody else's interests other than the state and the people of this state first.
All right, Senator Luno, is it that simple, as Jim states?
Well, in some instances, quite frankly, it is. I believe that there's no sound logic to refuse a measure like this. It's like I said, tax incentives are not altogether a bad thing. However, to let people go below zero on their tax liability and collect back money that they've never paid in is simply, it's corporate welfare. It's subsidizing companies, and typically these are the larger corporations that have all these kind of credits and things. So it's a pretty simple proposal. It's just you can go down to zero, but you can't go below it. Quite
right.
Frankly, in my personal opinion, I think they should be paying something. There should be a floor, and maybe that's 2% or 5%, but I think that everybody should have to pay some level of corporate taxation.
When does it go before the House?
It's going to be next week. It's not scheduled for this week. Their calendar was too full already, and it'll come before the House next week in committee.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on with Senator Luno.
Yes, Senator, are your Republican colleagues taking their marching orders from ATLA?
Well, I wonder that sometimes. They don't share that with me, frankly, but sometimes I wonder that. You know, we have lots of model legislation, and we have lots of influences outside of the state that come in and tell people how to vote and those type things. They've never really called on me because they know that I'm a pretty independent voter, and that I'm gonna vote the issues and not the organization. So, but that certainly could have some influence on it.
Lastly, Gustavo in Goodwood says, "What's the status on the concealed carry bill?"
The concealed carry bill, I believe, has made it over to the House side, and it is. I don't know if it's pending in committee or it's pending on the floor, one or the other. This was a bill that I was opposed to. I've been contacted by literally hundreds of police chiefs and police officers across the state of Louisiana that had serious concerns about it. And I can tell you this, their major concern was that they were afraid that especially young men that maybe otherwise would not carry a gun because they knew it was illegal to conceal carry would now start to conceal carry. And you add alcohol to equations like that, and sometimes it's a recipe for disaster.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The other thing I didn't like about the bill, we require kids in Louisiana to have hunter safety courses before they can go out in the woods and go squirrel hunting or shoot a duck or whatever. But we're not going to require people to carry a handgun concealed, which was one of the most dangerous weapons they could carry. I just think it doesn't make common sense to me to do that.
Well, we wish you well, and let's hope we talk in a month or so to get a wrap-up of where things ended. Thank you, Senator Luno.
Certainly. Talking with Thank you.
Take care. And we're joined in studio by Colonel Janet Humphreys, who lives across the river from us. She's been here talking about national security. She worked at the Pentagon in high places for many years, but she is a good citizen of Pointe Coupee Parish now, and that parish's historical society is holding a jazz brunch fundraiser on the banks of False River this Sunday, right?
That's correct.
So what's going to happen at 11:30, 10:30 actually, I believe, the tours begin. Tell us what's going to occur on May 23rd.
So the Historical Society, this is our big fundraiser for the year. It's going to be hosted at Bonnie Glen Planter's Cottage on False River, which has been owned by the Gosserand family. And through the generations, eight generations, the current owners are David and John James. And it's going to be hosted at Bonnie Glen outdoors. And luckily, we're going to have great weather this Sunday. The grounds, actually, the original settler, Antoine Gosserand, arrived in Pointe Coupee Parish in 1720. And I think a lot of people don't realize that Pointe Coupee has 300 years of history. He actually settled at the Bonnie Glen property in 1758. So people will be able to tour the grounds to include one of the 10 most historic barns in Louisiana that was built in the 1840s. So we'll be having the St. Cyr Jazz Band from New Orleans will be providing the entertainment. So people will be able to tour the grounds from 10:30 to 11:30, and then the music starts at 11:30.
And that band includes one of the world's best clarinetists, Dr. Michael White.
Absolutely. So Dr. White was a professor at Xavier University, band leader, composer, recording artist, jazz historian, musical educator. He's the founder of the original Liberty Jazz Band. He's a resident artist at the Lincoln Center and a frequent collaborator with members of the Marsalis family.
Proceeds will fund a permanent exhibit?
Yes. So our intent is to hire a professional museum exhibit designer to actually put together at least the beginnings of the 300 years of Pointe Coupee history for a permanent museum installation at the Padres Center, which the Historical Society owns.
All right. Well, it's at 10:30 this Sunday. The tours begin. New Roads, banks of the False River, and it's an area that people in that location will know, but for those who might want to go or hearing this, don't want to get lost. Let's make sure they find the right spot. What are some of the markers that will enable them to get to the right place?
So the address is 9099 False River Road, New Roads, and we'll have, it's right at the edge of the property is Curette Lane, so we will have that well-marked probably with balloons. We'll have a deputy sheriff out there directing traffic as well for people to park behind.
We've got it under control. That's 9099 False River Lane, and it's, of course, more information. And if you want tickets, the number I have, Janet, is 225-638-6575, 225-638-6575 for the Historical Society. Garden party attire is encouraged? Is
yes,
that,
please.
What is garden party attire?
Dresses or a nice pair of slacks for the women, and for the men, open collar shirt and a pair of trousers.
No, that sounds good. And it is a gorgeous location, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Property features an ancient live oak, the Bonnie Glen Oak, which is on the Live Oak Registry, and music, as mentioned, will include the St. Cyr Jazz Band of New Orleans featuring Michael White, a fantastic museum, the founder of the original Liberty Jazz Band and resident artist at the Lincoln Center, frequent collaborator with the Marsalis family. Thank you and good luck. And as we note, as we part company this morning, we learned early today that Charles E. Buddy Romer III, 52nd governor of Louisiana, died today. He was 77 years old, and he was elected to Congress in 1980. So turn the clock back 41 years. He was a young man, 36 years old, and then elected governor in 1987 when he was 43, the same age that Edwin Edwards was when he was elected from Congress to be governor. Unlike Edwin Edwards, who Romer defeated, he did not serve four terms. He only served one, and he got involved in the weirdest of matches in 1991, in which he was a candidate as an incumbent. And to the right of him was David Duke and Clyde Holloway, and to the left of him was Edwin Edwards. So on election night in 1991, it was Edwin Edwards in the primary, a memorable October 19th, finishing with about 33% of the votes. David Duke was right at 32, Buddy Romer 27%, and Clyde Holloway got 6. So Holloway's votes were essential as well, and Holloway was the endorsed Republican in that race. And then Edwin Edwards defeated David Duke 61-39%, but Duke did receive 671,009 votes, and many of those people who voted for him are still living in Louisiana, still voting, but there are a few people who voted for David Ernest Duke for the Senate in 1990 and for governor in 91 who will acknowledge it. But Buddy Romer was a person who wore his heart on his sleeve. He was a Democrat when he was elected in 1987 in one of the most remarkable campaigns of all time in our state. He vaulted from fifth to first in about a month, in an all-star cast that included Billy Tozan, Bob Livingston, Edwin Edwards, and Jim Brown, all of whom were formidable politicos and all thought they were going to win. But it was Romer, after getting the endorsement of the Times-Picayune front page on a Sunday in September, who vaulted from number 5 to number 1 on primary day, and Edwin Edwards, in one of the most brilliant moves of all time, on primary night, October actually, it was October 24th, I believe. He threw in the towel, and he did not go to the post for the runoff. He did not enable Buddy Romer to get a mandate, and that allowed Edwin Edwards to come back 4 years later and unseat Buddy Romer. And Edwin Edwards lost only one race in his long career before a lark at running for Congress in 2014 against Garrett Graves. He lost that one, as we know, pretty handsomely in a gerrymandered district. But Edwin Edwards, at that time, had never lost a race, and he'd been to the post more than 20 times in his career, and Buddy Romer finished first, and Edwin Edwards pulled out. Buddy Romer became a business person. He did try running again in 95 and lost. His campaign manager, by the way, was John Kennedy, but he became a successful business person. His bank, Business First, is thriving today. We'll be talking more about him in the days to come. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Until next time, thanks for listening and stay tuned.